Shabbat Vayeshev, and he settled, or and he dwelt. The portions then, this week we heard from the Torah, from Bereshit, Genesis 37, 1 through to 11. From the Haftarah, that was from the prophet of Amos, that was 3, verses 1 through to 8. And from the Messianic writings, right at the very end of that Besorah narrative, we have from Lucas, and that was chapter 24, and verses 13 through to 27. You'll see why that one has been tacked on the end a little bit later on, as we're going to come back to that passage and some of the themes and ideas around that passage. But first of all, we have to say Happy Hanukkah, everyone! You're still awake. Okay, we're halfway through the service. Hang on in there. The donuts are coming. Okay? But first, you've got to listen to this. Then you can have a donut. And finally, oh, isn't it finally, after all these weeks, something to be cheerful about. They fought against us. We won. Let's eat! Which is what we're going to do afterwards. It's the way that it always is in Jewish history. The battles that we fight, that the enemies of Adonai continually to think that in some way they can defeat God. What a foolish lot they are. You can never defeat the one true God. It is pointless to even try. And you'd think, would you not, that this particular moment in time, that our traditions, Jewish traditions around Hanukkah, would be rammed full of the wonderful miracle of the mighty military victory over the dominant Greeks who had fought against us, who had taken over our country. And we know, I'm not going to repeat the whole history here of the Maccabees and the family that did this, and the courage and determination that led them to take on the mighty, mighty Greek army at that point, and saw the victory. Surely, yes, this is a miracle in its own right. And I've been pondering this week, thinking, when you pick up the history books to do with Hanukkah, I would really expect to see the historical reality of this battle being yelled from the rooftops. We fought against Greece and we won. If that was me, that's what I'd be doing. Right? You know, I'd be going, all we had was a couple of plastic spades and whatever, and we still managed to come against this mighty army that took over our country in this way. And it is a miracle. I mean, I've got no doubt about that. We have to shout this. It's a miracle that just a small, dedicated group of people like this could even begin to think that they could overcome the Greek army and win, but they did. This is a miracle. And yet, what is it that we encounter about Hanukkah? I guarantee you, if you open up any school book, then RE or RS or whatever it's called nowadays, because they keep changing the name of it, whatever it's called, you open up the book and there you are, and the kids are saying, so what does Hanukkah mean? And the teacher will open up the book, and what is going to be in the book? I guarantee you, you're going to be seeing Hanukkiot. You're going to see bucket loads of oil, and you're going to see donuts, and you're going to see dreidels, and you're going to see all the bits and pieces that go with it. And these are wonderful, wonderful things. And our tradition, oddly enough, and I mean oddly enough, because you've got to think of what's going on militarily at this time, our tradition focuses on the miracle of the 8 days of oil. A miracle which in fact was only first mentioned in the Talmud some 7 centuries after the events took place. 700 years. It's the first actual historical mention of the 8 days of oil in this way. So I just thought to myself, hang on a minute. This is a Jewish commentator that I was reading about this and thinking, whoa, that's a long way after. So I thought, what do you do? Well, you go to the historical records, right? Because that's what you've got to do. Where do we read about Hanukkah? 1 and 2 Maccabees, right? So you go to 1 and 2 Maccabees, and then you discover that they don't mention the oil either. In fact, interestingly enough, I found 2 Maccabees actually talks about the miraculous find of the original altar fire hidden away until Nehemiah discovered it and brings it back to the temple again. That's a kind of a miracle which is in 2 Maccabees in this way. I thought, oh, something I hadn't picked up on before. Apparently this is the thing. So I thought, okay, well, if it's not in the historical bits, then surely, you know, if you want to find out something, go to a Jewish historian. Right, who's the best Jewish historian we have of that time period? And I know that there are issues around the fact that he had to pacify the Romans and so on, but you're obviously going to go to Josephus, aren't you? Because Josephus knows. What Josephus doesn't know is not worth knowing, right? He knows about everything, so I thought, right, Josephus, you're my friend, tell me about the miracle of the oil. Nope. He describes it as a festival of lights. That's fair enough, as we know. But no other mentions about it. I'm thinking, like, this is crazy. So I thought, right, you know what to do? I know there's someone who kept Hanukkah, right? And we know who's a historical record. I know where it is. We read it this morning in the Besara from John. So I went there and I thought, okay, here we go. This will tell me all about the miracle of oil. And of course, it doesn't. Yeshua kept the festival as we know, but there is no mention there either of the miracle. Okay, so what are we going to do? I mean, I find this fascinating that the issue, that the thing which is focused on within Judaism around this time of Hanukkah is something for which you are absolutely looking at a paucity of historical evidence. And I can hear someone saying, oh, Rabbi, here you go again. You always want evidence, don't you? You always want that. You always want to drill down deeper. You always want to find out. Well, yes, I do. Now, it's entirely possible, plausible, almost quite likely, I would think, although we've got to couch it in that way, that the rededication of the temple did take 8 days. Why do I think that? If you actually go back to when the first temple was dedicated, and you can read about this in 1 Kings 8, it's all there, I'm not making it up, go back, go and read about it. It took 8 days to dedicate the first temple, and what else takes 8 days? The Sukkot festival, which is why in 1 Kings 8 you read about the dedication of the temple during Sukkot, which would lead us to believe, without too much of a stretch of the imagination, that this also, the rededication of the temple, also they took 8 days doing as a reminder of the dedication of the first temple. So much, I think, is probably not too much of a stretch of the imagination. In fact, actually, to back this up, 1 Maccabees called this time the Sukkot of the winter. That's a good little quote from history, I think, handed down there. So why is it that by the time you get to Talmudic times, you're beginning at looking at what the rabbis are compiling and putting together about this time period, why is it that it seems the rabbis were intent on hiding the miracle of the military victory and instead chose to go for something which is tangential, maybe, who knows, about the oil, and decided to big that up rather than the military victory? Both of which I think are miracles, if you want to put it this way, but why choose one over the other and then push that down through history as the defining feature of what this is all about, the 8 days of oil? And one answer I think you could immediately say in all of this, you can't blame the rabbis on one hand. I mean, Greece is gone, but Greece's friends are in. You got the Romans on you. And would you, as a rabbi in the first century, second century, going on a little bit beyond that, you're beginning now to think about codifying the traditions, the oral traditions, and putting them into writing, which would later become the Talmud. Would you, as a rabbi in that time period, write something in saying, wonderful, we absolutely beat and defeated, and Greece up, come on, bring it on. You're not going to write that. You'd have a Roman centurion breathing down your neck, going, excuse me, you're under our jackboot. What are you writing this stuff for? This is going to feed insurrection. We don't want this. I think it's entirely plausible, if you put it together, Sherlock style, You know, put the evidence together and see where it takes you. Entirely plausible, I think, that the rabbis decided in the end that actually it was probably a good idea to downplay the military victory and instead work with something along the line of the oil and the Sukkot and so on, coming up with, dare we say it, many Jewish people within the community, commentators and so on. Some will say this is complete fiction, others will say to your face it's completely fact. Take your choice. Either way, if the rabbis did come up with this story, it was a way that they could bring in an element of the power of God in a spiritual way into Hanukkah and taking it away from what was perceived maybe as being a purely, shall we say, secular victory by those Jewish forces against the might of Greece. All of this is probably lost to history in some form or other. And I think, yeah, we have to be fair about this. We have to act with history with integrity. You can't go too far with things. And you certainly can't start calling things facts which are not. That is not something within our power and our gift. But either way, from a purely factual standpoint, I have to say, the miracle of the oil, and we are celebrating in that way today, the miracle of the oil may or may not have happened. Honestly, it makes not one jot of difference to the story. They fought us, we won, let's eat. That's the truth. You know, it makes not one jot of difference one way or the other whether that story of the oil is true or false. But my point is this, and it's a bigger point that I want to make today in all of this. My point globally is this. What you believe and what you hold to be true are based upon the sources that you select them from and the authority we give them. That's the truth. The things that we believe to be true, the sources that put out the narratives that we choose to believe. I'm old enough to remember a time in the West when anything a British government would say would be absolutely believed to be true without question. Anything an American government said would be unquestionably accepted without anything, without any, no doubt, no nothing. Or they are the powers that be, we trust them and they tell us the truth. Without having to dig deep and try and work it out, it was said, it was in the papers, and you believed it. Because our confidence and our trust, our sense of their authority, and therefore their own obligation and duty to tell us the truth was so solid in our minds, we simply would not have doubted it. Ladies and gentlemen, those days are gone. But it makes the point about the sources and the authority that we lend them to accept their trust. We need to look no further than the current war in Gaza to see the old adage attributed to Senator Hiram Warren Johnson in 1918. You may not know where it came from, but it's him who said this. The first casualty of war is truth. Incredible for truth lovers in our day, and I'm including ourselves in that and many, many others who love and seek the truth. How incredible to even comprehend that Hamas can deny the reality of their atrocities they perpetrated on October the 7th, but they've got the absolute gall to stand there in interviews and these are leaders within Hamas and say it did not happen, Israel is making it up. The sheer gall of this, to lie so brazenly. And they do it because we live in a world where people lie for a living. It has become normal. And I think they can get away with it because it points to a much greater problem, an issue with truth right now in our culture. And I'm not just talking about being the inheritors of a postmodern society. I've talked about this before, you know, where truth is no longer truth, it's all become about our individual truths. We know that is a reality within our society and culture, but we are facing right now something so enormous, so destructive, which we simply have to acknowledge, and it's a huge issue in our culture right now. Now, I thought by this point I probably depressed you enough, so I thought I would show you a lovely photo of a kitten. Or a couple of kittens, actually. You love it? Are you happy now? You feel cheerful now? I did promise you a multimedia thing this morning, and we've got multimedia. There it is. Isn't that gorgeous? Beautiful little kittens, right? Do you like it, yes? Put your hand up if you think that's real. Oh. Oh, your hand went up. That's okay. No, it's not a trick question. Look at that. Is that a real photo? I've got news for you. It's an utter fake. Those kittens have never existed. They've never been born. They do not live right now. They do not exist. Nor does that scrummy looking cake, actually. It's a shame because I like the cake more than the kittens, but that's another story. But that you are looking at right now does not exist. I know it doesn't exist because my wife made that photo using AI this week. Freely available on the internet. And she told the, whatever it was, the bit of software, give us a photo of some adorable kittens with a piece of cake. And that's what it gave us. And you could have posted that on Facebook and said, no, I just bought these at a pet shop. Aren't they gorgeous? And I guarantee you would have had a million people going, like. And it's not real. My mind, thank you. That would be too distracting otherwise. Too many people like kittens. Come back to it later on. Don't remove it. We'll come back to it in a moment. My mind balks at the ripples of a photo like that, that almost anything in our world today can be fake. And I remember in the past attacks, I think it was in Lebanon, my mind nowadays is not quite as good as it used to be, but in the past, we know where Israel has attacked Beirut or something like that, and photos have been on the internet and in newspapers of these great plumes of cloud coming up over buildings and so on. You know, the famous one, which has now become very famous. And actually, afterwards, it turned out that there was a single pillar of smoke, and they had copy-pasted it 100 times to make it look so bad. It wasn't real. But that photo caused outrage in people, and it simply wasn't true. Take that down. I don't need it anymore. I'll come back to it in a minute. I'll let you know when, don't worry. I'm going to remove it. You'll have people going, oh, we don't need that. The problem we've got in all of this, and I cannot overplay this because it's so drastic, with the rise of AI in our society right now, we can read stuff and look at stuff and hear stuff which simply we do not know whether it's true or not. It's a real issue in our society. The tech has created a situation where it's possible to doubt anything and everything you see and hear. You know, you've seen some of the software where they implant someone's head onto another body and make it say different things, and it looks like it's a prime minister or a president who's saying these things, and they simply were not even in the building and they never said those words. I want to put this to you. This is not something new, actually, in some reality. It's a powerful passage in 2 Chronicles 18 to 19. Again, you can read it for yourself at home. It's a fascinating slice of history. It's all about King Ahab, and you know all about King Ahab. And King Ahab is determined to act and go up into war and battle, and he wants to notionally check with God, because this is what kings do. They do like to know that God is on their side. So he brings in his prophets, and he says to the prophets, "Shall I go up and fight, and will I win?" And all of the prophets go, "All hail the king, it's wonderful, you're going to absolutely slay him, it's going to be an absolute bloodbath. You're going to win. We're all going to come back and have a party. Except where there was one. If you know the story well, who comes back and says, this isn't going to, and King Ahab, perfect. Read it, it's hilarious on one level. King Ahab goes, there's always one, isn't there? There's always a party pooper. There's always you come back and tell me the truth. Well, I don't want to know the truth. Just tell me what I want to hear. And if I actually, the two Chronicles bit there, and it's also echoed in Kings as well, it's a fascinating bit. Why? Because it connects with what I'm talking about here, because what it also shows us in that narrative is the Lord's perspective in this, and says to the prophet, I am sending a lying spirit to the prophets. Now, I know that messes with your theology, and it does, because it doesn't seem to be something like the Lord would do, but that's almost not the point of what I'm trying to say today. King Ahab preferred to believe what he wanted to believe. He was not interested in the truth. And at that point, when he wasn't interested in the truth, the Lord sent a lying spirit to that nation to believe the lies. If you know how that story ends in those chapters, you will know why it is a tragedy for any nation to fall into the abyss of believing lies as truth. It is catastrophic, nationally, culturally, and for everyone in that country. And it absolutely brought disaster on King Ahab. It was actually led to his own death. The prophets who should have known better chose to speak falsehoods. But one thing literally leaps out the page at this point. Once the truth is dead, a nation falls. And it did. And you know where it led to? The northern nation of Israel was then taken out into captivity. It was over. Game over. Finished. And it begins when truth dies in a nation. It's interesting also, I think, Yeshua predicted such times as this were going to come, didn't he? In the Surah of Matthew, shall we? Predicts the chaos of these end times will be characterized by such falsehoods and fake theories. You know, he said, didn't he? He says, in those days, people will say, oh, Mashiach is in the desert. Oh, Mashiach is over there. Oh, Mashiach is in, I don't know, is in Costas. I mean, you know, he's effectively saying, in those days, every single person's going to be saying this, that, and the other. And he says, don't listen to them. Because they're lying to you. Effectively, he says, in those days, when we get right towards the end of all time, and by the way, I was reading something that someone said this week that said effectively that talking about the end times is such a Christian thing. Get over it. The end times are Jewish. There's more apocalyptic end time Jewish stuff than there is Christian stuff. Trust me, I've read it. There's a lot more out there about the end times in Judaism and Jewish thinking. There's nothing Christian about that. This world's going to end. It's not news for you. Sorry if that's brand new news. If that's a shock for you, I'm apologising. It's going to come to an end. And if history tells us anything from Chronicles and Kings and all the bits that run through this, the end of anything comes when truth goes. When the truth is gone and lies rule and people choose to believe lies rather than the truth, the end is not far away. Yeshua said as much. Lies will dominate and truth will be at a premium. In fact, wasn't just Yeshua that was warning us about this. We can go to something that Shaul also was writing here. And he was writing this to Timothy. This comes from his second letter to Timothy. And I'm just jumping in here in chapter 4. He says, you know, preach the word, he says, in and out of season. He says, because, the reason why he says, preach the word, keep teaching the word, the Torah, the scriptures. He says, keep teaching this. Why? He says, because. For a time is coming when people will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires and wishes and wants and needs, because they have itching ears, The latest this, the latest that, the bit on Instagram, the bit on TikTok, and the bit on anything else that's out there under the sun. They've got itching ears to see and hear it all because of this and their own desires and the fact that they don't want to hear the truth anymore. They will heap up teachers for themselves. Or in other words, they will build their own echo chambers. And they will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to fables, myths, nonsense. I'm reading that as Judaism today, not Christianity. When Scholl wrote this, there was no church. There was no Christianity. No other new religion existed when Scholl wrote this. He was writing it as a Jew, a Messianic Jew, to Jewish believers dotted around the Mediterranean basin. And he was writing to them, teaching them bits of Messianic Judaism they needed to understand. Now read this, understand this as a Jewish comment, as a Jewish insight. For time will come when people will not endure sound doctrine, the sound doctrine of Judaism. The Torah. Ooh. A time is coming when people will reject the Torah as truth. Well, hello, that's going on. According to their own desires and itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers. Now, you could translate teachers there as rabbis within the Jewish time frame and context if you want to. Either way, one way or another, we don't have to push the point. But they will heap up for themselves their own rabbis who will tell them what they want to hear. And they will turn their ears away from the truth of Torah and turn aside to myths, fables, conjecture, tradition, wrong understandings. And he's saying that as a Jew to other Jews, not to Christians. Fascinating, isn't it, when you see it that way? The time will come when we will not, he says, be eager to hear the truth of Torah. But what we will want is the latest myth, the latest tradition, the latest bit of whatever it is that comes along, fables, teachings of men. Oh, just give me what I want to hear. I'm going to be happy. I want to hear. Just give me this. And Shaul is warning us that these times are coming. I would say to you, they are here. Right now. You know, I've had people say, you can explain to believers that Yeshua is Jewish, he's the Jewish Messiah, he was never a Christian, and they will swear blind to your face that you're a complete nutter. I don't know what you say at that point, except to say you've lost your touch with reality. Of course he's Jewish. There's nothing else. The history's clear. I'm not making it up. If there's one thing we do know about Messianic Jews is that we have a passion for the truth. In history and in theology, to unearth what's been hidden for 2,000 years and bring it out to the light as the truth and reality by which we should be living. That's on which we stand. But you know what? We're living in a world where anything goes. You know, can you actually believe this? There are people, seriously, there are people who are believers who think the earth is flat. They exist. They do. I know some. Think the earth is flat. Any weird idea or theory is up for grabs because today we've disconnected with the truth and with reality. Anything that tickles our ears and makes us think this or that or the other. You know what? Gullibility is not a fruit of the Spirit. It is not. We do not have to be gullible. We have to have a heart that seeks the truth. And just because someone writes it in a book or in a newspaper or an article or you've downloaded it from a friend's friend's TikTok account does not make it true. You've got to look at what they're saying. Do not be gullible, people. Nor should we be creating, according to Shaul, personal spiritual echo chambers to only hear what you want to hear. You know what? My library is full of books I absolutely disagree with, and if I was not so academically minded, I would probably burn them. but I do not, because I want to see and read and understand. I want to see what the opposite argument is and check it through to see where truth is. You know, I've had people sitting on my sofa upstairs, ripping into me, ripping me to shreds because of what they think is true and blah, 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 blah. And I sit there and I have always patiently listened. Why? Because if a donkey can speak the words of God, then so can someone who is angry with me. And I have to listen to see where truth is. And I can assure you, even when I'm being shredded in that office, at the end of it all, when they've gone, I'm left with maybe just four or five thoughts and ideas where I can go to the Lord and say, there may be some truth in this, and I therefore need to pray about it. That's integrity. I'm not blowing my own trumpet. We should all do this. We've got to be more spiritually alert in all of this. If we want truth, we have to go to the source of all truth, and that is Adonai and his word, his Torah, his teaching. If you want the truth, you go to the source of all truth. To take anything at face value in today's world is dangerous. We have to be like those wonderful Bereans who've been handed down for us in the book of Acts as a testimony to all of this. I love that Berean group there. They didn't just grab the spiritual headlines about Yeshua. It would be easy to do, wouldn't it? All the hoo-ha and all the froth and all the excitement of the miracles. And imagine if the disciples are in town and suddenly, oh, let's all go. There's miracles, there's this and there's that. And they've all got caught up with the excitement and so on. Truth out the window. We're just going with the latest thing. The latest bandwagon has come in and off we go. It would be easy to do this. The Bereans didn't. Even with all of this, what did the Bereans do? Took their Bibles off the shelf. Well, they didn't, of course, because they didn't have them. They took the Torah scroll, they unrolled it, and the scrolls of the prophets. And what did it say according to the book of Acts? They read and studied and they dug deep in the Torah to, quote, find out if these things were true. Because they knew the secret. And we need to know the secret. The truth is in the scriptures. Because it's the word of God which has been given to us from heaven, from the God who is true. And is truth in all things. What a wonderful community the Bereans were. You know, again, I want to say to you, even Yeshua, out of all people who walk this earth, I can imagine for a moment, if you just put yourself in his shoes, I know we can't, we shouldn't, and we mustn't, but imagine what a human being at that point would be going like, you know what? I can make these people do whatever I want. You, come and follow me now, here, you, now. You don't, could be done. Did Yeshua do that? No. Not once. The people who ended up following Yeshua, the ones who were amazed at his teaching, watched what happened, looked at the miracles, checked it out, saw what was going on, and these people, the scriptures recalled for us, chose to follow him. Yeshua did not just use the power he had and the authority he had to demand discipleship, demand that people followed him. In fact, actually, what he did do is what we heard in the reading there from today in Luke. It says he expounded the Torah, showing them everything concerning himself. I love that passage. What a wonderful day that must have been. They looked at him. It's fascinating in so many ways. They looked at Yeshua and he didn't quite understand that it was Yeshua. Have you read that? Have you had it this morning? How did they understand it was Yeshua? When he opened up this and began to teach them. And that's when the light went on. You're Mashiach, you're Yeshua. That's when they understood, because he taught them everything in here concerning himself. See, there's a lot of people out there in Judaism, broader Judaism, will say, oh no, he made it all up and there's nothing about it. And you know what we have to say? Absolutely categorically wrong. Everything Yeshua taught, everything he did, everything he connected with the dots in his own life, not just what he did, but who he was and everything he achieved in his life, all was drawn from the Torah. every single bit. And he was tested by Hasatan in the wilderness, wasn't he? And yet Yeshua could have just said, oh, get away from me, get out of here. And Hasatan would have been gone. It's not how he chose to deal with the situation, was it? What did Yeshua do? Unrolled the Torah and started reading from it. Why? Because truth defeats darkness. The truth defeats darkness. Because darkness loves lies. Darkness loves the little blend of truth and lie and the mix and the grey areas and the slander and the, right? Darkness loves that. To sow doubt in people's minds and hearts. The darkness loves that. The truth brings light and darkness flees. The truth is always in the Word of God. Yeshua avoided the cheap, I'm your leader, so believe in me, I'm the Mashiach, so just believe in me and do what I say. He avoided all the cheap tricks in that way. He just pointed them all to the source of all truth, the revealed words of God. And Yeshua could have said, as he says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He knew he was the truth. And he could have enforced it. But he chose to show people the reality and let them choose to follow him. All the way through, and according to Sheol, and the letters of Sheol and elsewhere, how many times do you read, and according to the scriptures, Yeshua rose from the dead? Or according to the scriptures, Yeshua did this. Again and again and again and again. Why? Because it's based on the truth. Now, we looked at a dodgy photo earlier. I'm going to bring it back up now. Here we go again. Wait for it.
Oh.
How do you know it's a dodgy photo? Actually, you can tell them right now that it's not a true photo. Did you see it? Did anyone see it? What is it? Go on, Emmanuel.
Oh, it looks like it's another.
There's another paw. How many paws do those cats have? Can you see it?
Yeah,
when you see it, you see it. It's not immediately obvious. One of these cats is a mutation, it's got 5 paws. It's got an extra one coming out to pat the cake. It's really weird. It's cream. No, it's a paw. It's a paw. There's a lesson here for us. It's over long, and it's touching the cake in a very strange kind of way. It is possible to see a fake at the minute. AI is not quite perfect yet. I mean, we know it's trying to get there, but you know the way that you would spot that to be fake is exactly this. You've got to look closely. Look at the way the doily underneath the cake is reaching out to the cat's paw. It doesn't quite look right, does it? Yeah? If you look closely, it doesn't seem to fit, it doesn't seem to work, it doesn't add up, does it, in that way? This is called discernment. The way you see whether something is true or not is to go back to the scriptures, go back to the Word of God, and see whether what is being preached and taught fits. See if there's an extra paw. See if there's something in the teaching which is extra to the teachings of the scriptures, and whether or not that is true. Whether or not you should accept it or not. Because it's the scriptures that are true. And I always say this, because people just say, oh no, Rabbi, you stand there and you mouth off every week and everyone believes every single word you say. Please don't. I'm not the Word of God. I'm preaching. If I make a mistake or get something wrong, forgive me. I'm human. I will always say, go back and check. Go back and check the scriptures. That's what I want to survive. Not what I'm saying. This is what I want to survive. The Word of God. The Torah. Because that's what God has given us. We are meant to have discernment. And we're meant to have the same approach to see. Just, yeah, it sounds good, but I don't know. Just, is it... You know, for so many people in today's world, it's good that people are doing this. It's not good if you're deeply involved with something because it rocks the boat. But many people today are having a fresh look at Christianity and are concluding it doesn't add up. I'm not saying everything is wrong in it. This is not a baby in bathwater thing. You know, there are bits which are true. But it's like the fifth paw. Every now and again you stumble across it and go, is that doesn't quite. Now, I remember one of our number here many, many years ago, when he was first immersed, said to me, for the first time I get it. I didn't get it before because it didn't make sense, yes? And it's only when it was put as a Jewish understanding of what immersion is that they go, oh, now I get it. Now it makes sense. And got immersed. Same is true of rabbinic Judaism. You know, there's many people today, not just within active Jewish communities, but within academic Jewish community, there are many, many, many who are beginning to look at the history and development of rabbinic Judaism coming out of the first and into the second century and beyond, and are beginning to raise question marks going, it just doesn't seem to make sense. It's not fitting. It's not working. Certainly in many ways it doesn't appear to be working well today, but I would say the same is probably true of Christianity also. But again, hear me, I'm not saying chuck it away. I'm saying it's not a baby bathwater situation. There are bits that do fit, there are bits which are true, and those we need to keep. Truth is truth wherever you find it. It really is. Now, we have a monopoly on truth. The only person who's got a monopoly on truth is the Lord. If people discover truth in various ways and build it into their lives, it is no less true because of that. All truth comes from God. We must dig deeper. You know, when Pilate asked Yeshua, what is truth? He was remarkably prescient for our modern age, wasn't he? Even he was a bit confused. Now, I began by asking a historical question about the oil at Hanukkah. Did it happen? Maybe. I've taken you on a bit of a journey this morning to get back to this again, but you can see where I'm going with this now. I want to put it to you, this side of eternity, we will probably never know whether there was a miracle of oil at Hanukkah. Does it matter? Probably not. It's not crucial. I'm happy for it to be a tradition. I'm happy to light the candles. And I'm happy, very happy, to eat donuts. But the issue is this. What you give authority to will define the truth you live by. Put it back into our Gaza situation. You've got Gazans there who refuse to accept that the bloodbath that took place in Israel on October the 7th ever happened, because they are choosing to put their authority on those who are lying to them. That's how this happens. Where you place your authority will define the truth that you finally have in your life. If the traditions are your authority, go ahead and believe the miracle of the oil is true in history. Mazel tov. I'm not stopping you. That is fine. If tradition is true, then you will believe that the Pope sits on his chair and has a hotline to God. That's what you choose to believe. That's your tradition. Go ahead. No one's stopping you. But we have to see where we put our authority, where we choose to say, what is the source of the authority that we allow to define and build truth into our lives in a world where truth is difficult to find. Where everything you see and hear may be wrong. And I'm not trying to get you to wobble this morning and think, help, who knows whatever is true, who knows if I'm even here, gone. You know, that's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm asking you to do is dig, analyse, find out, and see if it is true. Don't just accept things. And this process that we go through, ultimately, is only one place you can really fully put your trust and your confidence in the truth, and it's this, the Torah, the Word of God. Because God is true, and every man a liar. For those of us whose source is God and His Word, we must take a more cautious line with everything we see and hear. Just because someone tells you the world is flat and gives you a book the size of a doorstop doesn't make it any more true. You've got to go find out. It's important, truth. If truth gets confused and a spirit of lies comes into the culture, it brings destruction. People, we are dangerously close to this destruction in our culture right now. Because there's a whole load of people out there believing a whole load of lies. Can we know in the age of AI what is true or not? Yes, we can. It's not desolation. It's not that we abandon all hope. We can know what is true in the age of AI because we read the scriptures. It begins with, as the scriptures say, having a relationship with God. If you know God, you know his salvation, and you're studying his word as the bedrock of truth and reality in your life, then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And I want just one final thought for you today before we finish. And this is a word for us, it's a word for everyone who's listening from around the world today. I want to say this to you. Don't be afraid of the truth. Wherever you find it, don't be afraid of the truth. If Yeshua is Mashiach, then that is true. And oddly enough, he doesn't need me to defend him at that point. The truth will always defend itself. If Yeshua is the Mashiach, I want to say to my Jewish brothers and sisters, if Yeshua is the Mashiach, you have nothing to fear and everything to gain. It's the truth. And the truth will set you free.